Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Today, fertilizer from cornfields is leaching into groundwater and rivers. Levels of nitrates are so high in some places, the water is unsafe to drink.
We need to rein this in and get some management going, because if we continue at this rate, what's our water going to be like in another 40 years?
From Harvest Public Media series, Watching Our Water, we'll hear what some farmers are doing to turn things around. Then we visit a local bakery to see how challah is made. And
my grandma and grandpa used to they knew where the trees were, and on their walk home from school when it was pawpaw season, they would eat these until they got sick, you know.
Daniel Orr makes pawpaw bread to be enjoyed in moderation, and some okra pickles for the end of the season. What happened in the week of food news? Here's Mark Chilla.
For the second year in a row, five consumer, environmental, and public health groups released a scorecard for 25 top fast casual restaurant chains. The report found that twice as many companies as last year made stronger policies against the use of antibiotics, mostly in the raising of chicken. The grading system that the coalition used takes a broad set of factors into account, from transparency to policy follow-through, but there is still lots of confusion about what antibiotics-free really means. Last year, the coalition found that only 5 of the 25 had committed to use meat raised without antibiotics. This year, 9 out of that group had moved to restrict antibiotics use. The USDA says that meat can be labeled no antibiotics added if the producer convinces the agency, with paperwork, that the animals were raised without those drugs. Meat labeled organic must go through a much more rigorous certification process, and any animal treated with antibiotics for health reasons cannot be sold under the organic label. The vector for superbug infections from the meat industry is generally considered to be from workers exposed at farms and factories. But as we reported last week, new evidence shows that meat containing resistant strains of bacteria are indeed making some people sick in higher numbers than previously thought. Also last week, the UN General Assembly held a meeting to discuss what some are calling the crisis of antibiotic resistance. Health advocates are looking to American lawmakers and companies to lead by example. They say the move by fast food chains to stop serving animals that were treated with antibiotics is a first step. And McDonald's has been rebranding the old familiar bake sale. When schools on tight budgets need to raise money for field trips or extracurricular activities, they used to sell cookies and fudge or magazines you never wanted. Then along comes McDonald's with a twist called McTeacher's Nights, in which teachers volunteer to become employees for a night at the fast food chain, and the school gets a cut of the proceeds. Amid growing concern about childhood obesity and moves to curtail junk food sales to kids, more than 50 teachers' unions, along with health advocates, have pushed back with a campaign to shut down McTeacher's Nights. They've tracked more than 600 McTeacher's Night events in more than 30 states. McDonald's says these events have raised millions for education, with an estimated $2.5 million raised between January 2013 and fall of 2015. But advocates say schools generally receive only 15 to 20% of the proceeds, and found in a survey that schools receive an average of $1.18 per student. We've compiled a list of this week's news stories in the podcast post. You can find that at eartheats.org.
Okay, Mark, thanks.
See you next week, Annie.
Cornfields can't grow enough feed for livestock and ethanol for cars without big doses of nitrogen fertilizer. And that fertilizer, in the form of nitrates, is damaging water quality across the Corn Belt. As part of Harvest Public Media's special series Watching Our Water, Grant Gerlach reports on how some farmers are stepping up to address their part in nitrate pollution.
Living in the Platte River Valley in central Nebraska means understanding that the water in your well may contain high levels of nitrates and may not be safe to drink. Ken Syme lives near the town of Chapman, and he learned that lesson long ago.
When our first son was born in 1980, we actually put a distiller in for our drinking water here in the house. And at that time, our water level was at 12 parts per million.
That's over the legal limit for public water systems. But Syme says some wells in the valley contain nitrates at dangerous levels two or three times that. For Syme, this problem is personal because he's a farmer. He and his sons grow about 1,000 acres of corn and soybeans. Some of those nitrates probably come from his farm.
That really puts it in perspective of we need to rein this in and get some management going, because if we continue at this rate, what's our water going to be like in another 40 years?
Two things happening on Syme's farm are good examples of how corn growers are trying to make things better. They're using technology to put less nitrogen on the field and conservation measures to hold on to what's already there. Let's start with technology. Years ago, farmers would spread fertilizer evenly across their fields. Some plants would get more than they could use. Today, researchers at the University of Nebraska are studying how to spoon-feed corn with just the nutrients plants need, no excess. They call it Project Sense. In July, a Project Sense sprayer rolled through one of Ken Syme's fields. The sensors look at a row of corn, how big and green it is. Then the sprayer shoots just enough fertilizer on the plants to push them through harvest. Project Sense director Richard Ferguson says that leaves fewer nitrates in the soil that can move into water.
If we're applying less fertilizer and achieving basically the same yield, that's going to reduce the environmental impact.
Project Sense is still an experiment, but with soil and water testing, farmers already have tools to help them be precise with fertilizer. Still, some nitrates are always left behind. In Nebraska, they leach into the aquifer. In Iowa, they wash off into rivers. The city of Des Moines is suing upstream water districts because its water supply is so contaminated. That's where the Syme's second strategy comes in.
This right here is the common vetch.
Ken Syme's son Noah digs a shovel of vetch, cover crops between rows of corn. Cover crops like this vetch or rye, even kale, grow after the corn is harvested, keeping live roots in the ground. The Symes want those roots to hold soil and water, but the roots also hold nitrates on fields and keep them out of streams.
If you're holding that moisture in place rather than just letting it go through, we know that we're doing a better job of holding everything in place.
So if you grow plants to hold nitrates in the soil and spoon feed fertilizer, problem solved, right?
If I would just walk more, I would weigh less. It sounds really easy when you say it, but it's doing it.
John Heaston is a Nebraska conservationist who helps farmers work with technology. Heaston says the new tools farmers have are effective. It's just not enough farmers are buying in.
We have guys that lean into this stuff and they've got a techno lust and want to learn this. And then you have other guys that, you know, is pretty sure the internet is on computers.
Surveys by the U.S. Department of Agriculture show farmers in the Corn Belt are the least likely to use cover crops and have the most room for improvement on nitrogen management. Farmer Ken Syme says public pressure to address water quality is not going away. And he realizes that if farmers don't decide how to fix the problem, perhaps the government will.
If we won't be stewards ourselves, someone will have to help us be a steward.
Producers like the Symes are doing their share, but the effort across the landscape is inconsistent. And so far, so are the results. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Next time, more and more farmers are planting cover crops not only to improve their soil, but to keep toxins out of the water supply. Check out harvestpublicmedia.org for more stories like these. Daniel Orr is pretty busy with his own farm and his restaurant to do too much foraging this time of year. He was in the kitchen at Farm Bloomington in mid-September when he was alerted to the start of pawpaw season.
All I know is people started dropping them off here. So, you know, I think they come around about the same time as persimmon. So, you know, it all depends on the season a little bit. And we had a lot of rain. Pawpaws have been really great this year. They're called the Indiana banana. They have a little bit of a smell, kind of like a mango and a banana. If you want to smell that.
Yeah.
Do you get that?
Yeah.
And the tree has got kind of a large oval leaf, and you can kind of see them flowering in the springtime. Then you know you can go back there and get them later in the fall. They do grow in kind of muted light, so they don't have to be out in direct sun. So they can be kind of in a borderline forest area. Now, one of my cooks, Chris, loves to go out and forage, and she found these. She peeled them, and then you remove the seeds, which are quite large, and then you can push the flesh through a food mill.
He's making a quick bread with the pawpaws today. Quick breads don't require kneading. You don't have to let them rise. They don't have any yeast. It's a really basic recipe.
All right, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to butter and flour a little bread pan. You can use any shape that you want. It should be fairly small. We're going to make a fairly small loaf of bread. And you just butter the insides and then tap it around to cover all the sides. Okay, we're just going to put that excess flour in the bowl, set that aside. Okay, and then we are going to add the pawpaw puree. This is 1 cup of pawpaw puree. 3/4 cups of sugar, 4 tablespoons of unsalted butter at room temperature. And we're just going to kind of blend that together to incorporate it. So you can even put some raisins and other dried fruit or even nuts in it. A lot of people like to put walnuts and raisins in it. To this, I'm going to add 1 tablespoon of sweet seasons. That's one of my spice blends, but you could also use some pumpkin pie spice. We're going to add 3/4 teaspoon of salt and 3/4 teaspoon of baking powder. Baking powder is going to give us our leavener, which is going to make it rise and be nice and light. Okay, and then finally, we're going to add the rest of the flour. Okay, just mix that till it's smooth. Old-fashioned elbow grease. All right, now you can see it's nice and smooth. It's got a nice kind of light color to it. We're going to put that into our baking pan. Okay, get any air bubbles out of it. I'm going to pop this in the oven and we'll see what it looks like. Ooh, there's bacon in there. We'll put this up here. Okay, 350. Top oven's at 350, everybody. All right. Come back to the oven. All right, so we have the pawpaw bread out of the oven, and I'm going to slice some of it, and I like it toasted a little bit, and then it really kind of melts the butter.
That was some radio magic right there. In real life, you should definitely allow the bread to cool to room temperature before you slice it. This recipe and more pawpaw ideas, including cookies and a salad, are at eartheats.org. Get ahead of the game and find his pickled okra recipe also on the website. That's on the to-do list coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. I'm Annie Corrigan. Most of the seeds and chemicals used to grow the world's crops come from a handful of big companies. And now the largest of those are trying to get even bigger. But as Harvest Public Media's Frank Morris reports, the prospect of fewer companies controlling so much of the basic food supply is giving some farmers and antitrust advocates heartburn.
If you're looking for a Midwestern farmer this time of year, you need to climb into a combine.
Mark Nelson, hope, watch your head. There you go. You want ready for a ride?
Yeah.
Mark Nelson here says he's working 16-hour days, 100-hour weeks, harvesting corn and taking care of his cattle. He says he hasn't had much time to think about the huge companies he relies on for seed and chemicals joining forces.
It just doesn't. If I wanted to spend all my time worrying about that, I don't think I'd get any work done. My mind would be a mush, you know. So,
like most farmers, Nelson is getting squeezed. He's paying three times more for seed than he used to, while his corn sells for less than half what it brought 4 years ago.
That's a challenge. You're not going to be in the black, let's put it that way.
Farmers aren't the only ones stressed by low commodity prices, though. Seed industry consultant Bud Hughes says the massive companies that supply farmers are hurting, too.
And so to be cost effective, they've got to look for cost synergies. They've got to look to become a lower cost provider and find efficiencies in their research engines, find efficiencies in their cost of goods, etc.
And to do that, Agrigiants are pairing up like teenagers at a dance. German company Bayer is trying to merge with Monsanto, the world's dominant GMO seed company. Bayer is known for its aspirin, of course, but it's a leading pesticide company and holds some very successful genetic seed trait patents. Dow is trying to hook up with DuPont. Both companies have enormous agricultural divisions. Then there's ChemChina, which is trying to buy the Swiss biotech giant Syngenta.
It's scary. It's not good for the farmer.
Clyde Sylvester runs Sylvester Ranch Seeds, a business surrounded by corn and soybean fields in Franklin County, Kansas. He licenses genetic technology from the big companies to use in his own seed brands.
I mean, when you look at it, the world's food supply is going to be controlled by, what, three companies?
The proposed biotech mergers are setting off alarms in Washington, too.
I'm afraid that this consolidation wave may have become a tsunami.
Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley called a hearing on Capitol Hill where company executives defended the merger. Monsanto's chief technology officer, Rob Fraley, testified that biotech companies are racing to keep ahead of climate change, pesticide-resistant weeds, and the population explosion. To do that, he says, they need to spend big on science.
Because the solutions we need can only come if companies can embrace new technology, if they can increase their investments and accelerate R&D. And that's why you're seeing this latest round of mergers across our industry.
But Diana Moss disagrees.
The proposed mergers could well increase prices for biotechnology, eliminate choices for growers, slow down innovation, and raise food prices to consumers.
Moss heads the American Antitrust Institute and opposes a system where three companies could control four out of every five corn seeds sold in the world.
That this isn't only happening in agricultural biotech. It's happening in many other sectors. I mean, we have a sort of an epidemic of declining competition in the U.S. and internationally. We have major sectors dominated by just a handful of firms, two, three, maybe four firms.
Look at telecommunications, health insurance, even grocery stores. Regulators will likely force merging agricultural companies to sell off parts of their businesses. That could create openings for competitors. So, in theory, could the next generation of biotech farming. But for the near term, it seems likely that an industry tasked with feeding more and more people will likely be controlled by fewer and fewer companies. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
More at harvestpublicmedia.org. You eat challah on the Sabbath and on Jewish holidays like Rosh Hashanah, which begins this Sunday evening. Eric Shedler of Muddy Fork Bakery is doing a special bake this weekend, fresh challah, just hours out of the brick oven. I stopped by his bakery midweek to watch him prepare his test batch.
Especially for a holiday, you want it to be fresh. So challah is an enriched egg bread. Enriched means that it has some fat added to it. So it has flour and a little bit of sugar, yeast and salt, and eggs, and olive oil for the fat. Not everybody uses oil in the challahs. There's many bakeries that will use butter because of the flavor being nice to have a buttery flavor. But it's not actually traditional to use butter in the challah because Jews who keep kosher will want to keep dairy and meat separate. So using butter is a dairy, makes the bread dairy, and then you're only supposed to eat it with dairy if you follow those rules.
Muddy Fork is located about 15 minutes outside of Bloomington, Indiana. When you pull up to their spot, you see a hoop house and a lush garden. The house is up the hill from the bakery. Katie Zukoff is part owner of Muddy Fork with her husband, Eric. As he forms the challah, she tells us how she views the tradition of eating challah on the Sabbath and on holidays, now that their two little girls are celebrating with them.
I went to a Jewish day school, and we had challah at school every Friday. And we had an early dismissal on Friday. And so it was a time when the whole school got together, and it was just a time to relax and enjoy maybe just about 20 minutes, but enjoy being with our friends and teachers. We all took turns bringing in the challah and the grape juice for that.
I've got about 4 pounds of dough here for our test batch. Special challah dough with raisins in it. That's the tradition for Rosh Hashanah, is to make a challah with raisins, where usually it would just be dough without raisins. And each one of our rounds is going to be made up of two strands that we'll twist together and then roll them into a circle or a spiral, sort of like if you imagine taking a woven strand and making a rug out of it. That's how we'll do it.
I have taken a long time that I was not eating challah regularly and observing the Sabbath, but recently my daughter started going to preschool at Gan Shalom here in Bloomington.
I also make my own slice at school.
They make their own challah at school every week.
There we go. Got our favorite bench scraper for cutting the dough. Get a little flour for the table.
Yeah, each child makes a very small loaf.
Yes.
I'm going to spread out the dough into sort of a rectangle so I can get pieces that have a little bit of a bigger surface area. I'm going to roll some strands out of this.
And my other daughter is 18 months, and she also loves challah, and she even says, "Challah, please," when we get to school, and she wants some of her sisters.
I'm sharing.
Challah, please.
Pull out a pan and so here I'm twisting the dough into two strands together into a little rope, and then I'm gonna roll it up into a circle,
just like a bun on the back of a woman's head.
Exactly, yeah. In the morning I'll take them out and brush them with egg wash, and if they seem like they've risen enough, I'll put them in the oven, and if they seem like they haven't risen enough, I'll let them rise a little more before I bake them.
I can see that it's something that they really look forward to, having this time. Like, they sit on my lap and we sing songs also, and then we eat the challah, and it's a sweet bread and it's light. And I think all kids like bread, but challah is maybe just a little bit sweeter than your average sandwich bread. So it's something that they really look forward to, and we all enjoy spending that time together.
Challah, please.
Lita and Ruthie, along with their parents Eric Shedler and Katie Zukoff. Thanks to them also for sharing their recipe for challah. It's at eartheats.org to try yourself. What is it about okra that people don't like? Is it the sliminess? What is it?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people have had it cooked poorly, and it does have sliminess to it, but that is not a bad thing. And actually, okra is very, very healthy. What we do with it sometimes is not healthy when we deep fry it, which is probably everyone's favorite way to have it. But the seeds of the okra would actually have as much or more protein than edamame or soybean seeds. So
You just ate it raw. You can do that.
I love it raw. It's almost like a raw green bean. And that richness, we'll call it, instead of that sliminess, actually thickens really good gumbos. And then that's enhanced by using gombo fil, which is the ground sassafras leaves. And that also kind of richens it and gives it that velvety texture.
So we're going to pickle it today, though.
We're going to pickle it today. Today we're using a Burgundy okra, which one of our friends locally grows. Okay, so we're going to start by combining 4 cups of cider vinegar and 2 cups of water and bringing that to a boil. We'll get that going over there. And these are a refrigerator pickle, which means that they're not processed in a water bath, steam bath that's going to make them shelf stable. These you need to keep in the refrigerator, but they will last 6 months in the refrigerator because that vinegar and the salt preserves them. All right, so I've got about a half cup of kosher salt and a quarter cup of sugar. And I'm putting that into the container, and then I'm going to add some garlic cloves. We're going to throw in some crushed pepper flakes, about a quarter cup. We want to make these spicy. And then I'm going to add some other kinds of pepper. I've got some smoked paprika. It's got a really nice color. I love this ingredient. And this is going to add that kind of smoky hint to the pickles and give them a little bit of color. Then I also have another kind of peppercorn, which is called a Szechuan peppercorn. It's not related to the peppercorns that we think of, the black pepper and the white pepper. Those are the same things at different ages. This is actually the seed pod from a prickly ash tree. And what it's known for is not only to give some heat, but also to give a numbing effect. And that's one of the things that is very typical in Szechuan cooking, which is I really love. And Ryan, my sous chef over there, he's really into it.
It goes really good with spicy food. Like, it allows you to experience like the full spectrum of like a spicy flavor, but not be like in pain from it.
Oh Lord! Okay.
Chew on this. It's not hot. Chew on it, and just it's going to start giving off the flavor. Then you can spit it out, and then just let it kind of sit there. It's going to start to numb a little bit.
So wait for it.
And then we're going to add some thyme leaves, fresh thyme branches. And my water should be coming to a boil now. Okay, I'm going to put my okra in.
Oh, it just got numb. Whoa! That is a weird sensation.
One of my favorite dishes is crispy chicken, Szechuan style. And it's got, you know, it's just loaded with the dried chilies cut into pieces. And then it has the Szechuan peppercorns and everything. It's just really good. It's one of my favorite Chinese dishes. All right, now we're going to pour the boiling vinegar and water mixture over the top. Now we're going to let it sit in the fridge for at least 1 week. 2 weeks is better. But I've got some that we've made ahead of time. I think you're really going to like these. You can use these alongside a hamburger. They'd be happy in a dirty martini glass. It's nice. You get that sweet acid at the beginning, and then the smoke kind of settles in at the end. So these are our spicy okra pickles with smoked paprika and Szechuan peppercorns.
Love these. Ebon Binder snapped photos of the process. He was sort of hesitant about okra before he tasted these, so you gotta check that out at eartheats.org. Ebon also helps maintain our website, and he took the Szechuan peppercorn plunge with me that day in the kitchen, thanks to him. Thanks also to Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and the reporters of Harvest Public Media. John Bailey is our executive producer. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. All right, see you next time. I'm Annie Corrigan.